Don't be afraid to like this novel, even though most of the characters are losers, and you will likely find parts disgusting.
That's from a review on Amazon for a new book by Lawrence-based writer Bryn Greenwood. Here's a few others.
It pains me to have to give this beautifully written book 2 stars, but I simply can't give it more than that.
Wasn't a subject matter that I liked. It's dark in most places. I think the writing was fine.
This book won't pull at heartstrings, but instead yank out the entire organ and shake it about before lodging it back in an unfamiliar position.
Parts of the book were uncomfortable to read, but it made for a good discussion in our book club.
Okay, we were being a little hard on the novelist Bryn Greenwood by quoting those parts of reviews because a lot of readers loved her book. This is Central Standard, and I'm CJ Janovy, in for Gina Kaufman. I'm excited to talk with Bryn Greenwood, who's put together a story that some readers find troubling, but other readers find beautiful. Bryn's here in our studio. Thanks for driving over from Lawrence, Bryn.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we hear you describe all the ugly and wonderful things?
My go-to phrase is that it's a book about a lonely girl and a lonelier man and what they do to form a family, which apparently turns out to be problematic for a lot of readers.
Well, just to get a sense of that lonely girl, maybe just you could read us just a little bit here at the start.
Sure, absolutely. What I'm reading you happens fairly early in the book, and, you know, spoiler alert, Wavy, the main character, her grandmother is dying of cancer, and this is sort of their last scene together. "I wish I weren't afraid, but it feels like driving to a new place and not knowing where I'm going," Grandma said when she woke up. "We were alone, so I held her hand. I thought about Mr. Arsenikos, our neighbor where we lived before Mama got arrested. When Mama and Sean used to fight, Mr. Arsenikos let me hide on his back porch. He called me his stray cat and gave me bacon sandwiches. After I ate, he would sit out on the porch swing and tell me the names of stars. He used his cane to scratch them out in the dirt so I could learn them. He was a sailor on a boat called USS San Diego, which is also a city in California. His boat sank in the Great War, and he knew which way to row the life raft toward land because of the stars. On the chenille bedspread that was stretched over Grandma's belly, I drew Ursa Minor with his tail pointing down. 'Ursa Minor is north tonight, Little Dipper,' I said, because Grandma called it that. I drew it in the palm of her hand so she would remember. She nodded. By the time the sun came up, she was asleep again, and she didn't wake up. Mr. Arsenico said if you knew the constellations, you would never get lost. You could always find your way home."
And Wavy is about how old when she's...
She's 5 in that scene.
Okay.
And has already seen really a lot of things. As she references, her mother has been arrested, her father has been arrested. So she's already knows a lot more about the world than most people do.
And she knows the stars. And so I think, you know, that knowledge of the stars is one way we know that even at such a young age, she's super smart beyond her years.
She is bright, and it's useful to her because a lot of kids who are in these situations who don't have adequate mental faculties really do suffer a lot more because they don't have an escape route.
But she has those mental faculties, and she's also just, you know, from a literary perspective, what you did there was, you know, these stars that are so far away and so distant, they actually keep her very grounded throughout the book.
Well, they're a useful fixed point for her. She lives in a lot of chaos prior to being with her grandmother. She, you know, moved around with her parents all over. After she leaves her grandmother's house, she has to go back and live with her mother again. She's lived with other family. And the one thing that's been a constant, of course, are the constellations, because they always move in fixed patterns. Based on the time of year, you see the same things over and over again.
And that's how you navigate.
Right?
Yeah. So tell us more about this situation that she's growing up in.
Her father is a drug dealer. And naturally, he's also a user. Her mother is a drug user. She's surrounded by the people who work for her father, by various hangers-on, that sort of thing. And so there's always just a constant element of chaos. She doesn't know where food's coming from. She doesn't know who's taking her to school. She doesn't know any of those things.
She also doesn't speak?
She chooses the most economical method for communication. Primarily, that's because as a young child growing up around that sort of environment, you are taught not to speak very much about your life. And if that's your whole life, if that's being surrounded by all of this chaos, You just learn that it's safer not to talk.
And she, people around her think that she doesn't eat?
Well, she's a secretive eater. And this is a result of living with a parent who has some serious mental illness. And her mother is obsessed with issues of cleanliness. And so it goes back and forth on any given day. Is Wavy the one who's dirty? Is it whatever Wavy's put in her mouth that's dirty? And the end result is that it just becomes safer not to eat in front of other humans.
But she has a very creative way of you know, feeding herself.
Well, she eats out of the trash. She also wanders around her neighborhood. When they lived in the city, she wandered around her neighborhood. Out in the country, she goes to other houses. She steals food from people at night. She's like a little raccoon.
Right. Okay. So she's growing up in this awful environment, and your writing style is very short chapters from different perspectives. And so, as a reader, getting into the minds of all of these completely different characters for enough time to really sort of figure out what's motivating all these different people, it really gave me some empathy for some very, very unpleasant people. And how did you pull that off, writing from the perspective of all these different characters in her chaotic world?
I am kind of an obsessive writer, which is that if I get a story idea, I don't ever focus initially on one character. I focus on everybody who's involved in what I'm seeing. And so I end up writing a lot of different characters that maybe aren't going to end up being central to the story. But the flip side of that is it really has helped me learn to empathize with almost everybody because I'm always investigating, well, why does this character act this way? And often there's a good reason why they act that way, whether it's a good behavior or not.
We'll talk more about that good behavior or not, and why this, getting back to her behavior, you know, her eating, her not saying very much. Can you just describe some of these characters in her immediate environment that we get to know, even though they're unpleasant people, but that she's dealing with all the time?
Well, I mean, her mother is sort of top of the list, and I deeply sympathize with her mother, who does have mental illness and whose husband is abusive, and she's, you know, in a state of constant depression. And she's not a great mother, but I certainly sympathize with her because she's a terrible mother because of the situation she's in. Because she doesn't know how to deal with this responsibility that she has, and the result is that she doesn't really take responsibility. And then on the flip side, you also have the people, one of the main characters of the book, a man named Kellen, who is essentially a bag man for Wavy's father. You know, he's a drug dealer. He's not a great person, morally speaking, if we want to look at it that way. He's done a lot of bad things. But I totally sympathize with him because he's a young man when the book starts. He's come from an abusive childhood. He doesn't know what to do with his life, and he's just trying to make the best decisions he can.
Okay, so you've mentioned Kellen, who is the, what we call him, the love interest?
I never think of him that way, but I guess some people do.
How does Wavy meet Kellen?
He wrecks his motorcycle. He's been sent, they're living out on a ranch, I'll put that in fake quotes, in the middle of nowhere. And Wavy and her mother and her little baby brother are living up in a farmhouse while her father and all of his various hangers-on and girlfriends and employees are living in trailers down the road. And Kellen has been asked to take groceries up the hill to the farmhouse.
And well, the reason ranch is in air quotes is because it's a meth compound.
Well, exactly. They're not ranching. They're making meth. I guess it's a kind of ranching.
Modern and, rural Midwestern ranching.
That's right. Exactly. And so Kellen has been sent up the hill. He's gone up the hill on his motorcycle, and it's dusk, and he encounters Wavy and does not expect to see a little blonde girl standing out in the middle of this, you know, middle of nowhere, wrecks his bike, and she's the one who more or less has to save him. She has to let somebody know that he's been injured. And from there, that's the discovery point where you have this very lonely little girl and you have this man who's even lonelier, who's at multiple points in the book contemplating suicide. And they make friends, you know, against all odds.
It's pretty clear early on how she feels about him, and she's very young when she rescues him from this motorcycle accident. But then the book takes place over about 15 years, and we watch her grow. We watch her feelings intensify. She knows exactly what she wants. And I'll go ahead and say I was pulling for her. And yet some of what we heard in those comments from the reviewers, I was pulling for her, even though as I was feeling really uncomfortable about my own feelings reading it, and other people, I guess, were too. So what did you, were you trying to do that?
It's a natural outgrowth of the process. You know, when I always think of when I'm writing stories as investigation. I'm asking questions. I'm trying to figure people out. I'm trying to figure out what's happening and why. And with Wavy, a lot of the investigation is about what do you do when you're, and when she meets Kellen, she's 8 years old. What do you do when you're 8 years old and you have so much chaos in your life and you don't know who's going to take care of you and you don't know what to do? And the answer is you look for the one adult that may, in fact, be willing to take care of you. And in this case, it turns out to be this completely random drug-dealing guy who looks around at her life and thinks, this is really kind of bad, and I don't really like this. And he doesn't come from anywhere that he knows how to really raise a child, and so he approaches it as equals. You know, here's someone who needs my help. I'm going to make sure she has food. I'm going to make sure she gets to school. I'm going to make sure she has new winter boots. You know, he's doing all the practical things that he can see that need to be done. And of course, to Wavy, this is a good foundation. And she's getting that message from every corner of her life that what do you need to take care of you as you grow up? Well, you need a man. Every woman that she knows who's doing okay has a man. And so naturally she attaches herself to Kellen and decides that he's going to be her man.
So this is the setup, but that's the beginning of your investigation?
Well, that's how the investigation develops, is that you look at how do people respond in those situations. And so it became completely natural to me when I was writing, you know, from Wavy's perspective, that this is how she sees the world, and this becomes incredibly practical. She loves him, but the practicality is that she needs him. She really does need him to take care of her. And so she sets in motion a whole series of events that that change everything for everybody.
Let's go back a little bit, though, but why did you decide to investigate this question?
It's one that exists. I read in the news something really horrible the other day about this little girl named Victoria Martins, whose mother was a meth addict, and whose her mother's boyfriend raped Victoria and murdered her with her mother there in the room encouraging him. I mean, she was 10 years old, and these are the things that do happen to children. And so my investigation was, how do you make contingency plans when you're a child in that situation? And so that was part of it.
So you set these characters on this path, and am I correct in understanding if you're investigating this question, you didn't know when you started this story how it was going to end up?
No, I never do. I'm what they refer to as a pantser. I basically get an idea, and there's a character, and then maybe somebody else walks in, and I'm trying to figure out who all these people are. I never have any idea where it's going, and then by the time I do, often I'm like, oh God, why have I done this?
Meanwhile, you've created this world that you're living in because you're, how much do you write a day, or what's your process?
My goal is always to write at least an hour a day, but this book kind of got me by the throat, and I was writing roughly 10,000 words a day.
Wow.
Which is, yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. I produced the first draft in about a month, so I didn't sleep
with
a lot.
All of these different characters, and the final version is about 300 pages.
Yeah, it's about 120,000 words is the final draft.
Wow.
I never claimed to be sane. I didn't.
Well, so I want to talk more about the finished product in a second, but jump ahead a little bit. So there's more than 200 reviews of this on Amazon alone. We heard a little bit about them. Did you know, those comments that we had in the very beginning were pulling out some of the maybe more entertaining lines, but there were a lot of, one person said this was the best book she'd read in the past decade. Did you, Were you surprised by that response?
Not entirely. And part of that is because writing doesn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, the first draft does, but after you finish the first draft, you send it out to your 10 best writing buddies and say, "What have I done?" And you hope that their response is going to be something like, you know, "This is great, you should work on it," or rather than, "This is terrible, you should burn it in a fire." And so that's what happened, is I sent it out to people, and a lot of people came back and said, "This is the best thing you've ever written." So I knew that I had something. I didn't know really what at the time.
So how much time did you spend revising based on those comments?
About 2.5 years.
Wow.
So there's no payoff for being a fast first drafter in my book, because then I spent about 2.5 years revising.
Okay. I have many more questions about this, but we're going to take a little break. I'm CJ Janovy. Central Standard will be right back on KCUR. Okay, we're back. I'm CJ Janovy, in for Gina Kaufman, and we're talking with Lawrence novelist Bryn Greenwood about her new book, All the Ugly and Wonderful Things. So, Bryn, a couple of weeks ago, you wrote a blog, and you titled it, "For the People Who Hate My Book." What did you tell them?
I essentially told them, if you hate my book after you read it, that's totally cool. But if you decide to hate my book before you read it, that's just ignorant. Which maybe sounds harsh, except that I have gotten a lot of kickback. I get a lot of hate mail, I'll be honest. I get maybe 15, 20 emails a week of people telling me that I am, you know, subhuman garbage. Which doesn't really bother me because because they don't actually know me. And most of them, honestly, I don't think have read the book, which I think is problematic.
So where is, if they're not reading the book, they're reading a review, or they're...
They're reading a review, or they're reading this basic premise and saying to themselves, a love story between, you know, a grade school girl and a grown man. And they're essentially trying to retry me in the court of Lolita.
That's an interesting way of putting it, because I, you know, Lolita was in the back of my mind as I was reading, but then, you know, I'm not a fan of Lolita. I just didn't love the writing that much, but I loved the writing here. So how do you come out in the court of Lolita?
Well, I'm a big fan of Lolita, but that's because I love the writing. But I acknowledge that it's a book that's doing a lot of complicated things that people maybe aren't comfortable with. And I hope that that's the same reason people hate my book, is that it's doing things that they're not comfortable with, which is asking us to essentially inquire into issues like consent and, you know, child sovereignty.
Just say more about child sovereignty.
Well, we're sort of starting to discuss it as a culture, but when I was growing up, you could do pretty much anything you wanted to your own kids. There was no notion that children had the right to say yes or no to anything. In Kansas, you can still paddle children at school, I do believe, and certainly that was the case when I was in school. Parents could force feed their children. You could really do, essentially, short of killing them, you could do what you wanted to do with your kids, and there was no notion that children had a right to be protected from that.
So that's one of the things that you're investigating here also.
Yeah.
And do you... say more about how much you had Lolita in mind, really, as you...
I didn't.
Because you do love the writing. I mean, are you like, how did he make this beautiful?
I loved the writing, but no, I didn't have Lolita in mind at all, because Lolita is so clearly... It's a book that's intended to shock and titillate and make us incredibly uncomfortable, because it's about a narcissistic pedophile. I didn't really intend at all for my book to shock or titillate. I am more of the mind that I thought, there are people who have lived this life. I have lived portions of this life. And they don't see it in fiction. And I can't ever remember reading a book when I was a young woman that reminded me of some of the elements of my life that are in this book.
What elements of your life are in this book?
Well, my father was a drug dealer when I was a kid. We always joke around that he was a Midwest methamphetamine Al Capone, because he ran one of the largest meth production and distribution businesses in the Midwest. You know, if it had been legal, he would be a billionaire. So I'm very familiar with that, with the way that life works, with the sort of the meth ranch in the country and the hangers-on and drug-fueled parties and strangers and all of that.
This was in Hugoton, Kansas?
No, this was out in South Dakota. I grew up in Hugoton, but I spent summers in South Dakota, which was where his ranch was.
So or was this like Breaking Bad level?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's maybe bigger. I don't know. I couldn't really get into Breaking Bad, not least of which because I thought he'd be dead by now, some of the things that he does. And also, it surprises me the things that sort of upset me when I watch stuff like
that.
So.
Right. Well, so what parts of your life made it into this book?
Well, that element, certainly. But also, and this was the thing that maybe made me more comfortable investigating all of this and thinking about this, is when I was a very young woman, I had a series of probably ill-advised and certainly illegal relationships with much older men. When I was 13, I had a 28-year-old boyfriend that I was crazy about. We had a crazy, amazing love affair that I almost can't talk about to people because people shut down. And I can remember this even in college, having people just go into fight or flight mode over that topic because they would say, you couldn't possibly have consented, that you were a victim. And it's really disempowering to have somebody say to you, you were a victim, when you yourself are like, no, I was totally a consenting, willing participant in that.
How did that relationship happen?
Just, you know, random, the people you meet, you know. He was someone that I just knew. And it was awkward at first because it's the sort of thing where you're like, where you have someone who is aware that the situation is maybe not legal and you find yourself at 13 trying to provide compelling arguments to counteract that.
You mean to him, like,
yeah.
It's okay for you to be.
Yeah.
And were you aware at the time that it was illegal?
Oh, absolutely. Because that was maybe almost the first thing he said to me. Hey, I really like you, but no, because you're like 13.
And you said what?
I said, yeah, you know, but it's not like anybody's going to find out.
Did anyone find out?
Not really, no.
So how long did this?
About 2 years. And then after that, I dated a guy who was only 10 years older than me. And, you know, then eventually I worked myself around as an adult to marrying a man who was younger than I was. Maybe I got that out of my system.
So, and when you have these conversations with people now who have this fight or flight response, I mean, is that, getting back to the things that you're investigating in the book, is this a way for you to I don't want to sort of suggest that you're processing your own life.
Oh, but, God, yes, I am.
Okay.
Aren't all writers?
Well, you know, you want to ask a fiction author about the art of fiction as opposed to the influence of autobiography.
I assume that all fiction writers are on some level processing things.
Uh-huh.
It's just that your goal is to process them enough that the end product does not, in fact, look like a memoir or an autobiography, which I don't believe that my book does in any way, shape, or form. But it is about processing. And part of my investigation is about, because people, we want everything to be black and white, and to protect children, we have really black and white laws, which is good. We need to have laws that are black and white because there are systems in place to find the gray area. We have judges and juries and prosecutors and defense attorneys to produce gray within the black and white laws. But the law is not necessarily morality. I mean, we know it's not. After all, slavery used to be legal. It wasn't moral. It was legal. And I feel the same way about issues about children's capacity to consent to things. Is we know what's legal, but it's also worthwhile to investigate how little right do we give children to say yes or no. For instance, one of the things that I always find interesting about this is I get hate mail about two things. I get hate mail about Kellen being fat, and I get hate mail about the relationship between Wavy and Kellen. I never get any hate mail about the fact that at a certain point in the book, Wavy's father attempts to force feed her, and pretty brutally. Mm-hmm. He's, like some of the adults in her life, very annoyed by the fact that she won't eat in front of anybody. And he attempts to force feed her. And I think it's incredibly brutal. It completely violates her consent. It completely damages her sense of bodily sovereignty. I don't get hate mail about that. Why? Because do we accept that that's okay?
Seems like we do, is what you're suggesting.
I think on some level we kind of do, or at least it's not as disturbing to us as a child consenting to something we think they shouldn't consent to.
And so at the end of whatever you processed in the course of writing this book, and then these conversations that you have with people now, looking back, do you think that you were really truly able at 13 to consent? Were there times when you think maybe you were a victim? Or
no? I don't at all. And part of that has to do with whether the people around you respect that consent. And at 13, the man that I was involved with absolutely respected anything that I said no to, that was off the board. It was very much a case where I called all the shots, because he knew that if I wasn't calling the shots, he was definitely doing something immoral. He was definitely taking advantage of me if I was not the one to say yes or no. And when I grew up, when I hit 16, the age of consent in Kansas, I discovered that most men actually didn't care whether I consented or not. Once it was legal, there was some presumption that I would consent. And I went on to college and my adulthood and met so many women who had been coerced or bullied or outright forced to have sex. And a lot of them did not consider that they had been assaulted. A lot of them, it was their boyfriend or their husband who had done this to them. And because it was within the bounds of a relationship, and because maybe they, you know, maybe it wasn't a stranger raping them, they were kind of okay with having had their consent violated, because it's so common in our culture.
So what's the difference between, if you're just talking about the law in Kansas, what's the difference between a very smart, capable child who's basically figuring out how to live life successfully all by herself with no responsible adult supervision, who's 13, not able to consent to following her heart in the way that she wants to, versus this sort of arbitrary 16-year-old, okay, now you can decide?
That's part of my investigation, and I readily admit I don't have answers. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that certainly I have met 16-year-olds that I was like, you are not old enough for this. I used to work for Planned Parenthood, so I met a lot of teenagers who were in the process of investigating their early sexuality. And yeah, I met 20-year-olds that I thought, you know what, you get these birth control pills, but you maybe go home and think a little while before you do anything with them.
Right, right. So what did you tell the people who said, I hate you, in your blog post, to the people who hate my book, what did you tell them?
I do. I feel like if you read the book and you hated it, that's fine. I mean, I feel like a writer brings themselves to a book. A reader, if they're being sincere, they bring themselves to the book. Not every book is for everybody. There are plenty of books that people love that I hate, and vice versa. I'm totally cool with that. I felt like people who didn't read the book and hated it, hated the very idea that it existed, were in fact telling me that I shouldn't exist, because they were essentially saying, this book is so wrong that it should never have been written. Basically, your life is so wrong that you should have never written anything that you felt reflected your existence. Which, yeah, it's like, please delete yourself from humanity.
Do you ever get love letters?
Oh, yeah, no. And that's the nice thing. That's the reason I don't think I ever let the hate mail hurt my feelings, is I get letters from people who say, this book was so beautiful. And I get letters from people who say, I was in a relationship when I was 14 that was consenting, and this made me feel better about it after a lifetime of being ashamed.
What, I want to sort of talked about how this book actually even came into the world. So this is the third book that you've written.
Novel. It's the third book that's been published.
And the first one by a major publishing house.
Yes, this is what's considered my debut, because it's published by a big five publisher. It's St. Martin's Press. It's out of Macmillan.
So how did you convince a publisher to take this project?
I did not. That's what my agent is for. But no, I got an agent the Lana Turner way. That's what I like to tell people. It's the Lana Turner story. Because I queried this novel. I had had an agent before, but we didn't sell the book that he was working on. And so we parted ways. And when I finished this book, I queried it to 122 agents who said no. Some of them said no really nicely. Some of them said, it's a great book, I don't think anybody will buy it, which that's a nice rejection.
Talk a little bit more about querying agents, because that's like your entry point into a publisher. And so you have to convince them that this book with this premise is going to sell a lot of copies. And how do you do that?
Well, traditionally, the route is you write, it's a one-page letter. That's what a query is for publishing purposes. You write this letter that's essentially two paragraphs about your project. You've got to boil it down to the most compelling sort of Hollywood pitch session thing you can think of, and then a paragraph about you and maybe what your platform is or what your writing background is. And I did. I sent out 122 of those letters and got nothing. And I said, well, I guess maybe now is not the time, or maybe this book isn't as great as people told me it was, or whatever. And then out of the blue, I got an email from an agent who said, oh, I read your second book, which is unheard of because I think no one read my second book. I'm the only one who loves that book. My publisher didn't even love that book. And she said, do you have an agent? Do you have anything you're working on? But at that point, I was kind of done. I was moving on to work on something else. And so I said, no, I don't have an agent. Here's what I'm working on. And I sent her the manuscript. 3 days later, I had an agent. She loved the book. 3 months after that, she sold the book at auction. So yeah, it was a big turnaround from 122 no's.
So how did she convince New York publishing world that this material was a story that the world needed to hear?
I don't know how agents work their magic. That's what you need an agent for, because they have their own special magic. But more or less, she pitched it to them the way I had been pitching it to agents, which is, you know, here's this incredibly problematic story about a little girl who's growing up. And they eventually packaged it. The phrase love story ended up on the back cover, which I never used that to describe it, but that's fine.
And so that sounds like they were all in. They weren't asking for any changes.
Well, the day of the auction, I talked to, I think, 5 or 6 different editors on the phone. And one of them I had this total dread for, because I thought, oh, I hope she's not the winning bid, because she was saying things like, well, you know, we'd want to make a few tweaks. And of course, one of their suggestions was, you know, we'd make Wavy a few years older, we'd make Kellen a few years younger. And I was like, so you want a young adult novel? Because, you know, once you make Wavy a few years older, next thing you know, she's 16 and Kellen's 20. And, you know, there you go. Boom. It's a young adult novel.
But you were able to say no. I'm not.
No. Luckily, she wasn't the high bidder. So
okay, all right.
The high bidder loved it and did not make me make any substantial changes.
Okay, we just have just a couple minutes left, and so I'm wondering. You know, you worked out obviously some pretty big stuff about your life in this book. What's your next project?
The next thing I will tell myself has nothing to do with my life. It's about the future of circus sideshows and about a set of conjoined triplets. but the ultimate reality is when I'm writing it, no, it's totally about stuff I'm trying to work out. You know, me and my sisters, and we're not conjoined, but still we have issues to work out.
Were you ever in the circus?
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, aren't we all sort of in the circus? I was when my father's trial and conviction were on the front page of the newspaper every day. Yeah.
All right, we're just going to have to stay tuned for that. You'll come back and talk about that.
All right.
Okay. Bryn Greenwood, thank you so much for joining us. Up next, when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll bring you poetry that's very different from Bryn Greenwood's prose, but just as challenging. I'm CJ Janovy. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm CJ Janovy. Gina Kaufman is out today. With me now is Glenn North, who is a poet and no stranger to KCUR and Central Standard. He's been a guest several times. Welcome back.
Good to be here, CJ. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to talk to you about what it means to have the title that you've recently been bestowed, Poet Laureate of 18th and Vine. What does that mean?
Well, I've been doing poetry in the district and involved in all of the things that have been taking place there for 19 years. So I think in some ways it was a title given based on the work that I had already done and am doing, but also an opportunity to use poetry as a vehicle to further raise the level of visibility of the district in thinking of innovative ways to engage the community in and around the Jazz District. For instance, this summer we had with the support of Congressman Cleaver, a youth poetry slam, and the winner was able to visit Washington and to perform the piece that she won with in front of the Congressional Black Caucus. So things like that. I'm working on a poetry anthology that will coincide with the KC Jazz Walk of Fame that will highlight some of the inductees and really just a further celebration of jazz and the history of the district in a way that I have been doing, but to offer perhaps a larger platform.
You, I recently went to a reading there when you read some of your new work, and I think you have a new book out.
Yes.
And, I, you know, since you're a poet, I just mostly want to hear your poetry.
Right,
but
right.
One of the pieces that I think is in this book that really moved me was How to Mourn a Brown Boy.
Well, I will say that it's not in the book.
Okay.
I was asked to do that after the book had already gone to print. But yeah, it was a poem that I was asked to do at a fundraiser for an organization called KC Mothers in Charge. And they're an advocacy group that is dealing with, you know, all of the violence that we see taking place in the community. And I was very honored to do that and would be happy to share that with you if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, you know, we hear about Kansas City now being the seventh most violent city in the country. And so in light of that, we're working with organizations like Kansas City Mothers in Charge to see what solutions we can explore. But here's the poem, How to Mourn a Brown Boy. Prepare while he is still alive. Know that from the moment your belly swelled with him, he was in the crosshairs. Tell the boy to pull up his pants, to walk with purpose, pursue greatness, but know that it won't protect him. After expending your maternal energy, realize there is a competing trilogy of blood, bone, and bullet. If it has been 48 hours since your last phone conversation, strengthen your index finger for numerous redials. Know his haunts as well as his homies and his honeys so they can be properly interrogated. Have a statement prepared for the reporters who pretend to care. Practice the 1,000-yard stare so you can look into the camera and plead with the perpetrator to turn himself in. Cry out for the folks in the neighborhood who saw something to come forward. Don't expect them to. Save 1/10 of all your earnings to cover the reward money. Stock up on candles and flowers and teddy bears to adorn the shrine where you will find the body outlined in chalk. Discover the thin line between funeral and circus. Every member of the family or community need not offer a eulogy. Have an array of photos prepared for the Rest in Peace t-shirts that will need to be printed. Clear out cabinet space for all the napkins, paper plates, and plastic cups that will be left over after the crowd in your home disappears. Learn to live with the silence. Realize that in the darkest hour, a mother's arms have the ability to embrace ghosts. Steel your heart against that moment each morning you awake to the returning grief. Arrive at the conclusion that there is no substance on earth that can fill the hole, but God can comfort the space around it. Help the hood discern the difference between snitch and witness, because senseless murder is everybody's business. Become initiated into the sorority no woman wants to belong to. Know that tomorrow it will be another mother's son inking the headlines. Go to her. She will need you.
Wow. What's been the response to that poem?
Well, it has received, first of all, at the event, I could tell that the women who are a part of Mothers in Charge really appreciated that perspective. It was difficult for me to try to find a way to write about it in a way that wasn't totally hopeless, but also real.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't want to add to their pain because they're an organization of mothers who have lost their sons to violence. But it's been in the Kansas City Star and was also published in New Letters. And so it's been received very well, and I think that people draw something from it.
How did you, as a writer, put yourself in that frame of mind to even be able to speak to mothers who've lost their children?
Well, I think that's something that you kind of inherently develop as a writer, and it's just a sense of empathy. And I think about my own mom and conversations that we've had and her concern about my safety and the conversations we had growing up and just talking to women who I know that have been in that situation and just kind of tapping into that and stepping outside of yourself and connecting in some way that I found to be effective because of the response that I've received.
I've heard you talk a lot about poetry's ability to heal.
Yes.
And I know that you've, over the course of those 19 years that you've been working in some capacity at 18th and Vine, I know that you've nourished a lot of young poets. You've created events and spaces for
yes.
people to speak their
yes.
poetry.
Right,
and
right.
that has to be a very gratifying feeling for you. And
It's awesome. I don't even know that I can fully express it because I never, you know, growing up or even in college, saw poetry as a vocation. But as I began to work with young people, I was able to see up close and personal. I've worked with, adjudicated youth, young people in juvenile detention centers. I've worked with people who've been incarcerated. I've worked with the homeless community. And time again, I've seen that even if the person, you know, doesn't have a natural gift for poetry or never considered themselves to be a poet, there's a catharsis that takes place when you have to sit still and be in touch and in tune with those emotions and somehow convey that within the context of a poem. And it provides healing. And there are some students who I've seen it radically changed the trajectory of their lives. And so it has become a ministry of sorts for me. Yeah.
So will that continue as poet laureate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, as I said, I think that and I'm very grateful to the people who recognized the work that I've been doing and who wanted to in some way assist me to take that message further.
So last time we had a long conversation with you on Central Standard, you had just left a position as artist in residence at the American Jazz Museum.
Yes.
And you now have a new position,
yes.
a new day job there
right,
in
right,
the district.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Right. I'm currently working at the Black Archives of Mid-America, which is also located in the 18th and Vine Historic District. It's primarily a research institution, but we have exhibitions and also public programming. And so with the public programming, I've started a poetry series called the Mbembe Milton Smith Poetry Series, which honors Mbembe Milton Smith, who was the first African-American to graduate from UMKC's creative writing program. And we brought in some outstanding poets, and we've also given some local poets an opportunity to perform there. And even in terms of working with the young people, I'm one of the organizers of the Louder Than a Bomb Youth Poetry Festival. So we hold workshops there and Louder Than a Bomb events there, along with Paul Richardson at the Casey Word Shop. And the American Jazz Museum is involved in that as well. So it's a different space. A lot of similar work is taking place there, but I'm very excited about that opportunity. And the institution is 40 years old. Horace Peterson III, its founder, was one of the people who had envisioned the revitalization of 18th and Vine and bringing the American Jazz Museum and the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum to life. And so, it's... And what's interesting is I grew up in this neighborhood really quickly. I grew up in there were townhomes. It was called Lincoln Gardens back in the 70s. They're no longer there. But right across the street from Lincoln High School, they're Vine Street Lofts now. But it's kind of like I've come full circle. Yeah.
The For people who haven't been to the Black Archives yet, in this new, beautifully restored new building that's sort of what behind the Jazz Museum.
Exactly.
Why is this sort of having a publicly accessible space important?
It's important to understand and recognize the contributions that African Americans made to the development of Kansas City. It's important to understand that during the era of segregation, that there was a thriving community here, and that story needs to be told. And it's our shared story. And Mr. Peterson believed that by looking at history, we can do a better job of where we are in the present and project a better future for our children. And in the programming that we do, we look at that history. We look at African-American history in general, but we also try to deal with contemporary issues and try to provide a safe space where a conversation can take place from people of all ethnicities, because, as I said, there's so many untold stories from various walks of life. And, you know, our school system has been so, forgive me for saying this, but so Eurocentric for so long that I think we do ourselves a disservice by not looking at all of our shared stories and understanding how that really comes together to create history in its fullness, and it gives us a better way of understanding where we are now.
I think of so people can go there and do sort of deep history.
Absolutely.
Looking at the documents.
Yeah. And our collection covers primarily Kansas City's history from 1850 to 1991, the contributions of African Americans. But we're still doing acquisitions. And anybody who's doing that research or who wants to learn more, that would be a conversation they would need to have with our archivist. But the information is there.
Yeah. I went to a reading there with Leonard Pitts Jr., the syndicated newspaper columnist who has just hasn't had a new novel out. And it was a pretty full room.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of thinking of the Black Archives as maybe the intellectual center of 18th and Vine.
Let's call it that.
Let's
Why
call
don't
it
we?
That. Okay. And as the poet laureate there, could we hear another poet?
Sure, sure.
Another poem?
Yeah. One of the ones we had talked about before I came on the air was The Lynch Family Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And this poem was inspired by a painting at the Nelson Atkins, which is called Lynch Family, a poem by a Jewish painter named Joseph Hirsch. And I just wanted to mention really quickly that it is on the placard next to the painting at the Nelson in the Modern Art section now. But it's a painting of a woman holding her son, who's obviously in distress. And there's this beautiful deep blue background. And the title does a lot of work in telling us that she's someone who has lost her husband or her lover to a lynching.
Okay. This is probably going to be the last word from you. So,
okay. Yes. Lynch Family Blues. Went out swinging last night, baby. Hope you didn't wait up for me. Said I was swinging all night, baby. Did you stay up late for me? I wasn't swinging in no joint, darling. I was out on the limb of a tree. Now I'm walking on air, baby. Feels almost like I'm free. My feet steady kicking the wind. Yeah, I'm close to being free. For the first time in my life, baby, white folks is looking up to me. Listen, son, your daddy loves you. Keep hanging on to hope. You the man of the house now. Gotta help your mama cope. Daddy won't be coming home no more. 'Cause I reached the end of my rope.
Glenn North, thanks so much for being with us this morning. Thanks for all the work that you're doing in 18th
and
Vine. Our time is up. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org, Central Standard, later today. And our podcast is on iTunes. Gina Kaufman's back tomorrow with a story of cutthroat Kansas City chef and a teenage fashion designer. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our team also includes Jen Chin and Andrea Tudhope. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm CJ Janovi. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.